What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jeremy Ben-Ami, Executive Director of the advocacy organization J Street. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's hard to believe that there are only 6 weeks left in the year 2013 and that time flies so quickly these days. Of course, time has been flying at pretty much the same pace all along. It's just that, like everyone alive, I am growing older, and it seems to speed up a bit every year. The good news is that Judaism sets up a number of ways to help us mark time's passage so that it won't seem as though it has simply vanished unnoticed. The major way we do this is through the plethora of holidays we celebrate over the course of a Jewish year. I was asked recently by a very bright bar mitzvah student why we Jews have so many more festivals and holy days than other religions. The answer is that we don't, necessarily. In fact, there are other religious traditions in which nearly every single day on the calendar belongs to a particular saint or festival observance. But Judaism does seem to have more major holidays than other faiths, and of course, they seem to last longer. In less than 2 weeks, we'll begin the 8-day celebration of Hanukkah, the Festival of Lights, yet another excuse for us to get together with family and friends and overeat for a full week plus. And while the historical and religious purpose for every Jewish festival is important, and they are all different, the overriding meta-theme of the complex holiday schedule we celebrate is that all of these holidays require us to pay attention to the calendar and to our own lives in a different and special way. Because we're constantly thinking about how and where and with whom we will be observing the holidays, we need to remember what we've done in the past years and what we are prioritizing for this upcoming holiday. When you say Hanukkah or Passover, it brings up the fact that we need to do some planning beforehand just to assure that we can fully celebrate as we should. Which reminds us that this is not just an ordinary part of the year. Basically, for Jews who follow the cycle of Shabbat and festivals, there are no ordinary parts in a year, and our lives, therefore, cannot be ordinary either. That is, Jewish holidays guarantee a kind of value-added life. In addition to the normal flow of work or study, of chores and errands and hobbies and pastimes, we are always connected to a kind of subtle flow of preparations, experiences, and aftermaths that make up a holy cycle which runs beneath the surface always, and on the surface during the festivals themselves. There's something uniquely beautiful about that, even if it requires cooking and freezing, say, 200 latkes in the weeks before your Hanukkah party, and having a house that smells of fried oil for the better part of a month. Because for Jews who connect to their Judaism in a regular, healthy way, the holidays bring added meaning, beauty, and value to the whole of our lives. And that makes even time seem to slow down just a bit. To play us in on this theme this morning, here's a pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the Festival of Lights from Armon Bizman, the new rock band at Temple Emmanuel, my synagogue, playing their version of Rock of Ages, Ma'oz Tzur.
Ma'oz Tzur Yeshuati V'chana El Shabeach Tikon Bet Tefilati Besham todan zabeach Le'etach in mateach Mitzahan rabeach v'shir mizmor Chanukat ha-mizbeah. Rock of ages, let our song praise your saving power. You amidst the raging foes were our sheltering tower. But furious they assailed us, but your arm availed us, and your word broke their sword when our own strength failed us. Children of the Maccabees, whether free or fettered, wake the echoes of the songs where you may be scattered. We'll see all men free, tyrants disappearing.
That was Armon Bisman and Sam Golden singing his version of the Hanukkah hymn Maoz Tzur for the coming holiday of lights and latkes, starting the night before Thanksgiving, November 27th, 2013, coming up fast. The Jewish political world in America has been transformed in recent years by the rise of an upstart political advocacy group that strongly supports Israel but believes in a two-state solution and in creating long-term sustainable peace in the Middle East. That organization, J Street, has become a favored destination for White House representatives who are reaching out to the Jewish community of America. Find out why when we meet Jeremy Ben-Ami, the executive director of J Street, when we come back here on Too Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We are delighted to welcome you to Jewish, our guest this morning. He's Jeremy Ben-Ami, the head of the fastest climbing Jewish organization in the world, I think is a fair assessment, J Street. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So J Street's ascent has been kind of meteoric. You were on here not terribly long ago, and J Street still seemed to need to justify itself in some ways because of the political climate in America, the Jewish political climate, not necessarily the political climate. Where do you see J Street right now?
I think we're planted now firmly in the mainstream of the American Jewish conversation on Israel. And it's a result of the realities on the ground in Israel, where the pursuit of a two-state solution is what the government of Israel is doing right now.
An accepted fact.
And a high priority for the Secretary of State and the President. So I think it's very much our agenda is now the mainstream and the center of the conversation.
It I have to bring up AIPAC because everybody does. You guys work well with AIPAC sometimes, not so much other times. What do you think AIPAC's perception of J Street is?
Well, I think they still view, and justifiably so, that they are the big kid on the block. They've been around for 60 years, done a lot of incredibly important work. What we are focused on is something that they're not focused on, and that is the active promotion of the two-state solution and the active promotion of American leadership to achieve peace. It's a piece of their agenda. It's not the center of their agenda, and I think that's we work parallel on those issues.
Recently, Avigdor Lieberman, the former foreign minister of Israel, was acquitted, or I guess acquitted, of all charges that were against him. They were a variety of corruption charges. He may become the foreign minister again. How does J Street view that?
Well, it is likely. I mean, this week I think he is going to be formally appointed and take that position. It is a shame that the government of Israel is to be represented in its external relations by somebody who has said publicly that he doesn't think that peace is achievable at this moment with the Palestinians. The prime minister seems to think it is. The majority of Israelis think it is. Most of the American administration thinks it is. So I think it's a shame that that position will be occupied by someone who isn't going to pursue it with the same level of tenacity that one would hope it might be.
We would hope that people would achieve peace and Rodef Shalom, pursue peace as well. We will talk much more with Jeremy Ben-Ami, the head of J Street, when we come back in a few moments here on 2 Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch, or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com again, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. Continuing our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the holiday of candles and presents, here's the immortal Tom Lehrer singing his slightly ridiculous Hanukkah in Santa Monica.
I'm spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica, wearing sandals, lighting candles by the sea. I spent Shavuos in East St. Louis, a charming spot, but clearly not the spot for me. Those eastern winters, I can't endure 'em. So every year I pack my gear and come out here till Purim. Rosh Hashanah I spend in Arizona, and Yom Kippur way down in Mississippi. But in December there's just one place for me,
Amid the California flora, I'll be lighting my menorah. Like a baby in his cradle, I'll be playing with my dreidel, spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica by the sea. I'm spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica, wearing sandals, lighting candles by the sea. I spent Shavuos in East St. Louis, a charming spot, but clearly not the spot for me. Those eastern winters, I can't endure them, so every year I pack my gear and come out here to Purim. Rosh Hashanah I spend in Arizona, and Yom Kippur way down in Mississippi. But in December, there's just one place for me. Amid the California flora, I'll be lighting my menorah. Like a baby in his cradle, I'll be playing with my dreidel. Here's the Judas Maccabeus, boy, if he could only see us, spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica by the sea.
That was Hanukkah in Santa Monica by the Jewish parodist, composer, and genuine humorist Tom Lehrer. Actually, there is one line in that song that's off a bit this year. It should say that he is celebrating a Hanukkah in November, not December. Well, at least not yet. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center here in Tucson, Arizona. Boker Tov, Oshrat. Good morning.
Boker Tov. How are you today?
I'm well. So you grew up in Beit She'an, but you spent a good deal of time on a kibbutz. Kibbutzim are a fascinating subject, very different from what they were originally, but let's talk a little bit about your kibbutz story.
Yeah, so for the past 8 years, we and my family in Kibbutz Hamadia, up in the north on the border with Jordan. And a kibbutz is actually a collective community in Israel that was traditionally based on agriculture. And the first kibbutz is still Dganya.
Dganya Aleph, the very first.
Yeah, Dganya
Bet, and so on.
You know, but you know, the Dganya Aleph would never say that there is Dganya Aleph because there is only Dganya. Anyway,
right.
Yeah.
Of course.
So it's on the Sea of Galilee.
Right.
And I don't know if you, of course,
this
you know
sort of
that.
This is royalty in Israel, Dganya.
Yeah, and actually Moshe Dayan and Ade Gordon and other grew up in Dganya. And did you know that Moshe Dayan was the second child of the first kibbutz?
Yeah, Moshe Dayan was the second child in the first kibbutz.
And I apparently know the first one.
And who was the first one?
Gidon Baratz.
See?
Yeah.
You must have won a contest with that
with
in Israel.
I worked with his son, Oren Baratz.
Ah,
here.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So,
So this is like the royal family for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has the same kind of resonance within Israeli
yeah.
culture. But if the kibbutz was in many ways the founding institution of the modern state of Israel, that's how a lot of people saw it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about your experience, because it's a different experience.
Yeah, and actually just a few words about like the kibbutzim continued the trend of, you know, the sabra, the new, the Israeli, not the one.
The new Jew.
Yeah, the new Jew. And actually, and the kibbutz that I lived is actually started, it was a star, like I was one of the top kibbutzim at the beginning, but in 2006 it went bankruptcy.
2006 and, it went
yeah,
bankrupt.
Yeah, and most of the people will say it went bankruptcy economically, but yeah, a book was written by Asafin Bari called Habaita, talking about ideology bankruptcy, like how it started and how it's end. And
right.
Actually, Asafin Bari says in his book, like the lucky ones died before the dream crashed landed.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
So those are the people that either died or left before it crashed.
Died. Yeah. Mostly died.
What went wrong?
At the beginning,
kibbutz?
It was very tight and focused ideology. Like everything needed to be communal, everything needs to be together. And I remember one of the great stories about the Dganya, that in the first meeting they decided not to have kids for 5 years.
Right, just to wait.
Yeah,
until
to
they
wait. And then, of course, Moshe Dayan was born 4 months later. But anyway, so I think that it was too tight for a human being.
Too close.
Too close. And I guess all the globalization and all the new opportunities that the new world bring, you know.
It's a different world
yeah,
today.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about kibbutzim mm-hmm. and about your experience living on a kibbutz mm-hmm. Next week. And just want to say, you know, for those of you who remember, the kibbutz was the ideal Jew. Mm-hmm. That was what Israel was going to be based on. It was the most popular image of Israel. So we'll continue to explore that with Oshrat next week. Toda rabah.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. Attention, Arizona income taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, J-E-T-C-O, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. Here's how. The state of Arizona allows its taxpayers to get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations, who then provide scholarships for kids from kindergarten through 12th grade to attend qualified private schools. JETCO helps provide a quality Jewish education to children in need at Congregation Anshe Israel Kindergarten, Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy. If you pay Arizona state income tax and make your contribution to JETCO, you'll get a 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax return. Tax credit's not a deduction. Your taxes are reduced by the amount you give. Join over 750 supporters last year who donated money to JETCO and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. There's an additional tax credit now, the switcher credit, which increases the maximum donation you can make to JETCO to $1,031 for single filers, $2,062 for married couples filing jointly. When we are fighting every day for the continuity of the Jewish people, we should all take advantage of this great opportunity. JETCO is one way to help foster a Jewish identity for our community's children. Contributions to JETCO have helped hundreds of children receive the financial aid they need to receive a good Jewish education. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, call 520-647-8442, again 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of education.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you're recently back from Morocco. Last week you talked about kind of an overview of how many Jewish places continue to exist in Morocco, even today after so many Jews have left. You had an interesting visit to a synagogue you'd never seen before.
Right. So in Fez, the synagogue, which is the first place they take visiting groups, which is actually still in use, and there are Sifrei Torah and whatever, was basically occupied by a group of Finnish tourists. And oddly, we kept crisscrossing this group of Finnish tourists. And you can imagine how shocked they were when, A, I recognized their language, and B, greeted them and said, hey, how you doing?
In Finnish. Finnish.
Right.
Yes.
It doesn't happen to Finns very often, especially in Morocco.
No.
So it was fun. But anyway, we wandered through the Medina and went to another synagogue, which had only been reopened in 2013. I can't remember if it was January or February, but earlier this year. And the restoration was paid for by the German Foreign Ministry. Now, so this is really an irony of history, that this very ancient synagogue, although not by any means the most ancient in Fez, this was in fact a synagogue that was built by and for Jews who were expelled from Spain in 1492. And the Fez community goes way back before then, as you know. But it was built by and for one group of expelled Jews, and its reparation and restoration, and they did a very good job of it, was paid for by a country which is still trying to salve its guilty conscience for the Holocaust.
Right.
And it's amazing because you know about German reparations to individuals and German payments to the State of Israel, but the Germans should probably do a better job of publicizing what they do around the Jewish world. This was a stunning example. In any case,
nothing like a German-funded restoration of a Moroccan synagogue in Fez.
Right.
In 2013.
Right. The city of Fez was probably put on the Jewish map or the map of Jewish consciousness by Rabbi Isaac of Fez, whose acronym in Hebrew is the Rif, R-I-F.
Rabbi Yitzchak Alfazi.
Right. Who wrote the predecessor of this sort of rule book of Jewish life, which is the Shulchan Aruch. And it was an attempt to organize in a logical way and extract all the legal decisions from the Talmud and put them into a form that was accessible to ordinary people who were not necessarily great full-time scholars. And that work was accomplished in Fez, which has a Jewish community that goes back really to the founding of the city. And the king of Morocco at the time that that community was founded only trusted the Jews with the salt trade. And he gave them a monopoly on the salt trade because he thought that anybody else, Berbers or Arabs or any other groups of citizens, might become too prosperous and powerful from the salt trade across the Sahara and pose a political threat. Whereas the Jews were a small enough group and a loyal enough group that they were safe. And hence the name given all through Morocco to the Jewish quarter, which is Melach, which is
salt.
Salt in both Hebrew and Arabic.
So. Great story. Thank you, Tom. We will talk next week.
Looking forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The Italian says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have wine. The Frenchman says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have cognac. The Russian says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have vodka. The German says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have beer. The Mexican says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have tequila. And the Jew says, I'm tired and thirsty, I must have diabetes. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and don't be tired and thirsty. And now a word of Torah. In a change of pace and literary emphasis within the text of Torah, Joseph becomes the principal character of the last four weekly portions in Genesis. This is a kind of developmental transition to the long narrative of Moses that will fill the rest of the Torah, a more complete story than any that precedes it in Genesis. The Joseph tale has been called the first truly modern piece of literature filled with contemporary authorial techniques in the delineation of character and plot. Each segment ends in a cliffhanger, and the interplay of storylines and locations make the whole narrative vibrant, rich, and exceedingly compelling. This modernity of style is particularly impressive, since the book of Genesis was written at least 2,500 years ago. The Joseph story stretches through a month of Torah reading. In the four weekly portions of Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, and Vayechi, we find temptation and cunning, nobility and baseness, carelessness and probity, juxtaposed, and then thoughtfully counterpointed. The foolish learn wisdom. The wicked grow to see the error of their ways. The impulsive learn restraint. Nothing is ever quite so simple as it initially seems. The Joseph story is a great story. It's also wonderful writing about fascinating characters. Joseph is one of the truly spectacular figures in the whole Bible. Brilliant, talented, arrogant, gifted with both remarkable vision and tremendous administrative skill. He is a youth of extraordinary promise who becomes a man of fate and determination, one who survives enormous trauma to reshape two nations' intertwined destinies. A remarkably contemporary character, Joseph is a brazen, spoiled boy who transforms into a subtle and deep man. It's not an easy process, but it begins with a bang in this week's portion. At the commencement of Vayeshev, our great ancestor, Jacob's beloved wife Rachel, has died in childbirth, giving birth to Benjamin. In a pained overcompensation, Jacob spoils Rachel's older son, Joseph, giving him a famous coat of many colors, perhaps no more than an embroidered tunic, the scholars tell us, and using Joseph as a tattletale to spy on his older, tougher brothers. The brothers' revenge is swift. Away from their father's eye, they capture Joseph and sell him into slavery at Egypt, and they tell Jacob that a wild animal has killed him. After adventures that demonstrate Joseph's newfound virtue and spectacularly bad luck, this week's portion ends with Joseph stuck in an Egyptian prison, his father Jacob in mourning, all hope seemingly lost. There are two central messages in Vayeshev. The first we have heard earlier in Genesis, but it is now reiterated poignantly. Our children are all precious. Favoring the good one does no one any good. Treat each child with love, as though, in fact, each of our children was truly an only child in receiving our love. That's the Jewish way to parent. The second and greatest abiding message of the Joseph story is that God's plan will work, but we aren't always party to why or how long it'll take. Transformation, moral and intellectual, must occur first. We struggle and sometimes suffer in order to learn what we probably should have known from the start, that God is the true source of all good and of all understanding. For Joseph, his brothers, and his father, wisdom will prove to be hard won. Perhaps in reading Vayeshev we can learn from their mistakes and so avoid the dramatic reverses of this great story. And then we ourselves might gain the wisdom to grow and change for the better. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Jeremy Ben-Ami, the executive director of J Street, will speak candidly about what Israel is doing now that helps or hinders the possibility of long-term success for the Jewish state and peace in the Middle East. Find out when we return on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Last week, we commemorated the 75th anniversary of Kristallnacht, the beginning of the Shoah, the Holocaust in Germany, and somehow stories from that darkest time in human history keep emerging. Sometimes they are almost unbelievable. Almost. An incredible tale came out of Germany at the beginning of this month, and the facts of it boggle the mind. An incredible treasure trove of Nazi-looted art, once owned by Jews, worth about $1.33 billion, was discovered in an ordinary apartment in a bohemian neighborhood of Munich 2 years ago. The story was broken by the German magazine Focus, and the German government authorities reluctantly confirmed the accuracy of Focus's report. Among the paintings and other pieces were works, some of them previously unknown, by Marc Chagall, Matisse, Klee, and Picasso. In total, more than 1,400 works of art were found in the home of wartime German art dealer Hildebrand Gurlitt, whose reclusive son Cornelius sold individual pieces whenever he needed cash. After becoming suspicious of Cornelius Gurlitt during a routine customs stop on a train from Zurich to Munich, German officials went to his apartment and discovered a carefully kept treasure house of stored modern art.
They seized the paintings, sketches, and sculptures from Gerlitt in February of 2011 and strangely kept it secret from the public for more than 2 years. The artworks were hoarded by Gerlitt's father, Hildebrand, a war-era art dealer put in charge of selling so-called degenerate art by Adolf Hitler in order to bring cash to the Nazi regime. Gerlitt's son, Cornelius, who was 80, kept them for half a century in a dark room in the apartment, following his father's death in 1956. The Nazis plundered hundreds of thousands of artworks from museums and individuals across Europe. Many are still missing. Coincidentally, a new film about the U.S. Army unit entrusted with recovering the looted art, called The Monuments Men, starring George Clooney and Matt Damon, is set to be released in early 2014. This Munich trove has been hailed as one of the most significant discoveries of looted art, fueling speculation about its provenance and claims from the heirs of Jewish collectors who were robbed, dispossessed, and murdered by the Nazis. A large portion of Hildebrand Gerlitt's treasure, confiscated from his son, can probably not be returned to the rightful owners, Focus magazine said, quoting an internal customs office analysis from the German finance ministry. No kidding. The legal status of this art remains murky. It is disputed nearly 70 years after World War II. Legal experts say Gerlitt may even get to keep it, but others say Germany could nullify his ownership under the 1998 Washington Declaration, a set of principles for dealing with looted art. The secrecy and delay in publishing an inventory of the works, estimated to be worth up to $1.34 billion, has been criticized by those who say that publicizing such finds is vital to finding the proper owners. The German government contends it was necessary to protect the art from theft until it could be carefully cataloged and its original ownership ascertained. The 80-year-old recluse at the center of this mystery, Cornelius Gerlitt, has now vanished. He has not been charged, but has been under investigation by the German government for tax evasion and concealment. Apparently, Gerlitt did not have a tax ID number. That's equivalent of a Social Security number. This is an impossibility for a citizen of modern Germany. Before the artworks were seized, Gerlitt sold a piece by Max Beckmann named Lion Tamer Circus for 864,000 euros via Cologne auction house, about $1 million. One of the best pieces in the collection is said to be Portrait of a Lady by Matisse, which belonged to the French collector Paul Rosenberg. Rosenberg lost his collection when he fled for his life during the fall of Paris. He was the grandfather of Anne Sinclair, the former wife of the disgraced Jewish head of the International Monetary Fund, Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Anne Sinclair has been a prominent campaigner for the return of art looted by the Nazis to their former owners. This story is continuing to emerge. Undoubtedly, more facts will come out in the coming weeks and months, but one last element is worth noting. The original collector of the looted art, Hildebrand Gerlitt, was one quarter Jewish. He was the scion of a German family that included a distinguished composer and a famous architect, both named Cornelius. But with the rise of the Nazis, being one quarter Jewish cost Hildebrand Gerlitt his job as director of a museum in 1937. It did not, however, stop Hitler's propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, from hiring Hildebrand to sell off the degenerate art the Nazis had stripped from museum walls and paraded around Germany, and to assemble suitable works for a Führer museum in honor of Hitler, supposedly going to be erected in Linz near Hitler's birthplace. Hildebrand Gerlitt was arrested for his Nazi collaboration at the end of World War II. Allied troops seized about 100 of these artworks, but he claimed during interrogation that most of his family's art collection had perished during the 1945 Allied firebombing of Dresden, and the family had had a home there. Because of his Jewish heritage, the elder Gerlitt was deemed to be a victim of Nazi persecution and released. And the Monuments Men squad, set up to protect the cultural property stolen by the Nazis, returned 100 paintings to Gerlitt in 1950. These included stolen works by Edgar Degas, Marc Chagall, and Max Beckmann. Gerlitt continued trading in art until his death in a car accident in 1956, and his son apparently continued to live very comfortably on the proceeds from selling stolen Jewish art for the next half century or so. Quite a story. We'll keep following it. In much lighter news, but still sad, a fire back in September at the Gabilis plant in Copiag, Long Island, New York, damaged the machinery that makes most of the knishes eaten in America. In delis all over the U.S., and of course on the streets of New York, square knishes have temporarily vanished. Kabila's, which also makes matzo balls, blintzes, and latkes, of course, sells the knishes both online and at retail outlets around the country, with New York, Florida, and California leading the sales. The factory swears an end to the knish crunch by Thanksgiving, which coincides, of course, with the start of Hanukkah. But by that time, you should be eating latkes, not potato knishes. So, if they miss the deadline, at least you'll again be able to get a real New York knish by the year 2014. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews, Rabbi.
We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Jeremy Van Ami. He is head of J Street. We're talking about J Street. We're talking about Israel. We'll talk about Washington, D.C. a little bit, too. Welcome back.
Thank you.
The Congress of the United States is an interesting place. It has become extremely supportive of Israel overall. J Street, in advocating for a two-state solution, which was, I think, really the formative motivation for creating J Street, now deals with a Congress very pro-Israel, but not all committed to a two-state solution. Tell me how you finesse that issue.
Well, the question is, what does it mean to be pro-Israel? And that's really the heart of what we're trying to change, in a sense, in Washington and in the Jewish community. There are those who would argue that to be pro-Israel means to back the policies and decisions and actions of the Israeli government no matter what.
My foreign country, right or wrong.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that includes things like expanding settlements on the West Bank and moving towards the possibility of annexing the very land that the Palestinian people are hoping to build a state on. And to our mind, that's not pro-Israel. The future of Israel and the survival of Israel as a Jewish and a democratic home depends on the separation of the Palestinian people and the Jewish people into two states, and any actions that move counter to that actually run the risk of putting Israel's future in peril. And so we don't consider that to be pro-Israel, and we have to help members of Congress understand that enabling settlement expansion, enabling possible annexation of the West Bank, which some members of Congress are on record supporting, is not an action that will promote the long-term survival of the state of Israel.
I want to move to a different area. President Obama famously recently asked Jewish lobbying groups to stop pushing on Iran and to give a hiatus, that is, in terms of nuclearization of Iran, and to allow the government's efforts and international efforts to work. What's J Street's position on this? Explain sort of the overall perspective on where Iran is now.
Sure. Well, the goal that I think everybody shares, and that's every single Jewish organization, the government of the U.S., the government of Israel, the goal is to stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. That's the goal of sanctions. It's the goal of diplomacy. It's the reason that we threaten the use of military force. That's the end goal. The president is saying we can achieve that goal. That is within reach through a meaningful, verifiable, tough diplomatic agreement. It's going to be tough to get to that arrangement, but adding in a new round of sanctions at this exact moment could set back the possibility of getting to the goal that we are all looking to achieve. So there's time to put more sanctions on. There'll be plenty, if a diplomatic agreement isn't possible and isn't reached, there'll be plenty of time for other actions. There'll be plenty of time for further sanctions and the consideration of military force. But don't take, he is saying, don't take actions now in this week, month, 60 days, it's set
whatever
back
it takes, right?
Right, the possibility of getting to an agreement with Iran to end its nuclear weapons search.
Does J Street have a perception of exactly what territorial compromise would lead to a successful two-state solution?
The rough outline is that the state that the Palestinians end up with has to have the same amount of land as the land that was won in 1967 by Israel. It doesn't have to be the exact same land. It can be swapped. So some of the major settlements can be kept in the state of Israel as long as you swap some territory for it.
Some of those major settlements are places like Male Adumim. I mean, they're basically cities. Very
right.
Difficult thing to give up.
Right. No, they're, you know, they're suburbs of Jerusalem. In some cases, they're neighborhoods of East Jerusalem.
Right.
And, you know, I think there's an understanding on the part of all involved that those will remain part of the state of Israel. But in order to keep that territory, something has to be traded. And that's the notion of a border based on the pre-67 lines with swaps. And the Arab League has accepted that as the basis for talks. The Americans have put it forward as the basis. It is the basis on which any model peace agreement that's ever been reached has been concluded. And I think that's one of the most important sticking points right now.
So speaking of model peace agreements that have almost been concluded or theoretically been concluded, if you go back to the Oslo process, they decided to put Jerusalem as the last issue. It was the hardest one. They thought they'd work through the stuff, build trust, and come to a point where they could make a final decision. Didn't work at the end. Where does Jerusalem fall? The old city, the holiest place in the world for Jews, the third holy, one of the holiest places in the world for Muslims, not to mention there's some Christians that care about it. How does that fit into this model, and has anybody even had the temerity or chutzpah to bring it up in these current talks?
It's definitely on the table, and all involved are saying that this time, if you're going to solve this, you have to solve all the issues and put them all on the table. So the Americans and the parties themselves have been very clear that Jerusalem is on the table along with all the rest of the issues. And I think for the American Jewish community, it's important to have a very honest discussion about Jerusalem and to learn the facts. There's a mantra in our community about Jerusalem being the eternal
capital,
right, you know, undivided, eternal. Exactly. And, you know, I think...
I also mentioned that's a mantra for pretty much every Israeli prime minister for a long time as well.
Right. And you know, I think we have to acknowledge that the current boundaries of municipal Jerusalem include 28 Arab villages that were annexed in 1968, and they include refugee camps. They include places that nobody, either Jewish Israeli or Jewish Americans, ever visited and really wouldn't want to visit. And those are the neighborhoods that... When one talks about having a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem, one isn't talking about putting a wall in front of the King David Hotel and saying you can't cross the street and go to the Jaffa Gate. What's being talked about...
Which actually used to be the case.
Exactly. You know, and that's not what would be under consideration. What's under consideration is that these Arab neighborhoods would become the capital of East Jerusalem, the Jewish neighborhoods would be the capital of Israel, and then the 1 square kilometer that represents the old city and the holy sites that are really the nub of the conflict, not only for
the center of the whole country.
Exactly, you know, and it's not just over the past 100 years. I mean, this is a place that has been a center of conflict for thousands of years now. You know, it may be time for us to think about a creative solution to this and say that really in the end, if you want to stop the violence, if you want to stop the bloodshed for generations to come, then nobody can have sovereignty over those holiest of sites, that it should be an open international city that is administered for the benefit of all the religions who worship there. And that 1 square kilometer, and that includes the Western Wall, it includes the mosques, it includes the church,
the Temple Mount, the Holy Sepulchre,
all of that.
Dolorosa.
Exactly. You know, that may well be God's, you know, rather than being belonging to any one human being or one religion. Let's agree that everybody should have free access to it, and let's stop fighting about it. That's a proposal that Ehud Olmert put forward in the 2008 talks. This is not out of the realm of possibility. It's been on the table.
Should you mention Olmert, you know, not exactly a left-wing laborite, so very interesting.
Right. And
go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's the key to peace right now, is that the folks who are advocating most strongly for an agreement are people from the center-right, the security establishment, the people like the former heads of the Shin Bet who were in the movie The Gatekeepers, people who have been the head of the IDF. These are the people carrying the case to the Israeli people that the future of Israel depends on achieving a peace deal with the Palestinians. You can't win this fight militarily. This is not going to go away over time with stronger and stronger security measures. You have to reach a diplomatic political agreement on how to split the land. And when you win the argument with the center-right, then I think you're ultimately going to be on the path towards a peace agreement.
It should be sort of notable that where J Street stands is where a pretty large majority of the Israeli public stands. Recent polls have shown something along those lines. What percentage do you think of the Israeli public supports a two-state solution?
Well, supporting a two-state solution is easy these days. You know, I think that, you know, you get 80-plus percent for the concept of a two-state solution. It's when you start to define that you start to lose people. And the interesting thing about Israeli public opinion is that if you lay out the entirety of an agreement, if I was to tick off the elements of a two-state deal that I think is reasonable and feasible, you'd still get 60 to 70% support. But if you ask people, do you think it will happen, you'd get 80 to 90% saying there's no way it's ever going to happen. And it's a mirror image on the Palestinian side. You get probably 50 to 60% support for the deal, and probably closer to 90 to 95% who would say it will never happen. So it's that lack of trust that's the biggest obstacle right now.
What do we say about the Palestinian belief in a so-called right to return, that all Palestinians get to go back to their former homes in Jerusalem, Jaffa, Haifa, wherever it was that their people, ancestors came from in the 1940s or 30s? How does J Street respond to that bargaining chip or serious request? Depends how you look at it.
Well, it's time to get real on all sides, you know, and to be serious about a two-state solution for Palestinians means giving up on the notion of returning to the homes that your ancestors were from. Just as for Israeli Jews, it means giving up on the idea of settling the entirety of the West Bank and giving up on the notion that you can't divide Jerusalem. These are realities that we have to start to talk about on both sides, and the Palestinians need to know, and I think many of them do know, that at the end of the day, you know, they aren't returning to the homes that their ancestors left 66 years ago. That doesn't mean that there isn't the need in a final deal for some form of acknowledgement of what happened and some form of resolution of their claims.
Or economic.
It could be compensation, right? It could be financial compensation. In refugee terms, it could mean assistance with resettlement in a permanent home somewhere else. It could be return to the state of Palestine. You know, it could be saying that every Palestinian has the right to become a citizen of Palestine, just as every Jew has a right to be a citizen of the state of Israel. And that, you know, is part of a package to make good on the wrong that happened to them in their eyes in 1948.
This all sounds very pragmatic. It would sound more so if it wasn't in the Middle East, of course. But the last time we came close to this, there was one problem then that didn't exist that does now, which is Hamas and an Islamicized Gaza. What does J Street say about that? What's the right approach to Gaza and to Hamas in particular?
Well, the approach to Hamas that's being taken right now is the right one, which is to say to them, you've got to give up this craziness about, you know, refusing to recognize Israel's right to exist. You can't use violence to achieve your ends. You've got to acknowledge the deals that have been made or will be made by the PLO on behalf of the Palestinian people. And if you do those things, then you can come back into the political circle and be part of the Palestinian discussion. But as long as you are outside on those issues, you can't be part of the solution here. And in terms of Gaza itself, the best way to handle this is to make a deal with the PLO that includes provisions about Gaza, but then puts those provisions on the shelf and says the peace deal for now will include only those portions where the people have voted to accept it. So if on the West Bank they have a referendum and they accept the peace deal, then there will be peace with the West Bank, and you have a shelf agreement with those in Gaza and say when you're ready, vote, accept this, and you'll have political reconciliation and be allowed back into the family of nations.
As we say in my business, from your mouth to God's ears. I want to thank Jeremy Ben-Ami of J Street for a great visit here on Too Jewish. What's the best place to go to find out more about J Street and participation in this process?
Well, two places. JStreet.org is our website, and you can find out a lot about us and the organization. Then we have a new campaign to support the peace process and support Secretary Kerry at 2campaign.org. The number 2, the word campaign.org, and that will tell you more about these final status issues we've been discussing and give you more information about all of the negotiations.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure.
Terrific. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Rabbi Gershon Sizomu, the chief rabbi of Uganda, of the Abu Yudaya people, the first sub-Saharan black African to be ordained a rabbi in an American seminary. He is a delightful and fascinating guest. Don't miss him. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the Great Festival of Lights, which begins November 27th, the night before Thanksgiving. Just 10 more shopping days until Hanukkah starts. It's from the Klezmatics, and it's actually a Woody Guthrie song. By the way, the Klezmatics will be here in Tucson. You can get tickets to their concert December 5th. This is a Woody Guthrie song. He was married to a Jewish woman and actually wrote a bunch of Hanukkah songs. This one's called Hanukkah Gelt, and it's a lot of fun. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.
Tickle me, pee-pee-up, tickle me, pee-pee-up.